Is there no power in the pardon for the Russian investigation? Hello and welcome back to the Rusted Culture Podcast. This is episode 58 and I am Frank Ebersold and it's good to have you back again. And one of the things that we want to kick off the podcast today is that discussion of, is there no power in the pardon anymore for the Russian investigation? What power is there anyway in this pardon situation? And to reference that, I've got an article in my show notes from Vox.com that I'd encourage you to check out. And this article from Vox has got an interesting sort of perspective. And again, in my show notes, it's right there. Check it out. It's got an interesting perspective about what little power there is in a presidential pardon at this stage for those who were involved in the Russian investigation. And of course, we're talking about George Papadopoulos, Rick Gates, and more importantly, Paul Manafort. And according to the article, if someone has been pardoned, they no longer face the threat of prosecution. And so they can't use a desire to avoid incriminating themselves as an excuse not to answer a question. So in addition to potentially obstructing justice, Trump would only leave himself and his colleagues more vulnerable if he decided to pardon anyone currently under investigation. Of course, folks, as you know, that doesn't mean that he's not going to pull the trigger anyway.
You know better than that.
Do I?
No.
Get out of here.
But here's the deal. Here's the deal, folks. This one scenario could work if the ship starts taking on water. This is the Nixon scenario. And it's coined the Nixon scenario by Susan Block, and she is a law professor at Georgetown University. And she says that Trump pardons them, and she means Flynn, Kushner, Manafort, and Donald Trump Jr., as he is exiting the White House, and Trump exits early, allowing Mike Pence to become president, and then Mike Pence then pardons Trump. Trump will then have successfully shielded himself and his colleagues from criminal liability. Of course, that then leaves us with Mike Pence, folks, who could leave us with a lot more to fear in a presidency than maybe even the president himself. But the business of pardons can get a little bit complicated here. Why, you've got the post-conviction pardon, which pardons for a specific offense, and then you've got the preemptive pardon, which is a pardon before conviction. And then, of course, we've always got the Fifth Amendment rights that we have to consider in all of this. And just to refresh your mind, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution is part of the Bill of Rights and, among other things, protects individuals from being compelled to be witnesses against themselves in criminal cases. And in this article that I've got on Vox.com in my show notes, there are 10 very interesting legal opinions on the pardon. And one of those is according to Mark Tushnet, who is a law professor at Harvard University. And I quote Mark, and he says, "It's generally thought that accepting a pardon constitutes an admission of guilt with respect to the offense for which the person was convicted. That prevents the government from prosecuting the person for that offense. But it doesn't operate as a general grant of immunity for other offenses, so the person who is pardoned still can assert his or her right against self-incrimination with respect to those offenses. The case of a preemptive pardon, that is, one that's issued before conviction, is different," he says. "The scope of the person's Fifth Amendment rights would depend on the scope of the pardon itself. If for only specific offenses, the person would retain Fifth Amendment rights for the other offenses. Basically, even after a pardon, people who Mueller wants testimony from will still be negotiating for immunity grants." It gets complicated, doesn't it? And the other caveat here to consider in all of this to the pardon is that if a pardon is issued by Trump that is seen as an attempt to block the Mueller investigation, well then, that pardon itself becomes an obstruction of justice just by itself. So pardoning in this situation has to be done very carefully if it's even done at all. So hang in there. We'll be right back. So moving on here, folks, did you see that Alex Jones, you know who I'm talking about here, old Alex Jones, the old high poobah of the wretched, and according to Axios, InfoWars, you know, which is the conspiracy peddling website and the radio show that's operated by Alex Jones, has received a second disciplinary strike from YouTube for a video that targeted Parkland shooting survivor David Hogg. And per YouTube's community guidelines, InfoWars will be unable to post new content to YouTube for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. That's kind of a blessing, isn't it? YouTube will be free of Alex Jones for 2 full weeks. What have we done to deserve that? Oh, thank you. Thank you, sweet Jesus. That's 2 weeks that we're going to be free. But there is the threat of a permanent ban from YouTube should it receive a third strike. Should Alex Jones get a third strike within a 3-month period, he's a goner. He's out of there. Guernsey. Well, the video in question is titled, David Hogg Can't Remember His Lines in TV Interview, wherein InfoWars, also known as Alex Jones, he alleges that David Hogg and his classmates, the ones that were just shot at in Parkland, yes, those are the ones, he maintains that they're crisis actors who've been paid to appear on television by the anti-gun lobby. Well, InfoWars is just one of several outlets that have actively promoted these conspiracy theories. Hack job conspiracy theories in the wake of the Parkland shooting. And because of that, it risks losing its access to more than 2 million YouTube subscribers if it receives another strike. What do you think the chances are? Wouldn't it be nice if I could come back and tell you that he's banned from YouTube? Wouldn't that be nice? So next up, folks, we have this burning question. Did Donald Trump just pick a fight with the NRA?
It doesn't make sense, Seth. I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Well, I think
you know why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
Well, in that bipartisan meeting that you just heard, in that meeting, according to the New York Times, that meeting was on Wednesday. And in that meeting, Trump called for comprehensive gun control legislation that would do 5 things. You're not going to believe any of them. The first point, the one of 5, is expand background checks to weapons purchased at gun shows and on the internet. Number 2, keep guns from mentally ill people. Number 3, secure schools and restrict gun sales for some young adults. Point number 4, Trump even suggested a conversation on an assault weapons ban. And point number 5, Trump advocates a ban on bump stocks. And folks, I got to tell you, I for one, am not going to resist Trump when he's advocating common sense gun control. That's what's going on here. It's hard to believe. He said it. And I think we need to be prepared to work together on this when and where work can be done and should be done on a bipartisan basis. All of what Trump just mentioned in this bipartisan meeting on Wednesday is what most past presidents would have loved to accomplish in the past. But what makes this a real possibility now, folks, is that it's coming from a Republican president. And despite the fact that it's coming from a Republican president, I really think we should embrace this effort for common sense gun control. Do you know that if Obama had said 10% of what Trump said in that meeting on Wednesday, he would have had an enormous backlash just because of who he is? And I think we've got plenty of other areas to resist Donald Trump on. We've got our pick. There's many areas. But when it comes to what Trump has said he's willing to consider on gun control in that meeting, this is not an area that we should resist. We should hold him at his word. and we should push for what he is advocating. This could be our best chance scenario, and we shouldn't blow it just because we don't like the messenger. We shouldn't blow it. Another reason we should charge ahead is because the NRA is at their weakest right now with a Republican president. They don't have Obama to point at while glaring, "He wants to take your guns away." They don't have that anymore. So as a result, what we've seen the NRA actually become, they become more like an extension of Breitbart News. They're peddling far-right causes, anything, folks, to coalesce support among their base of 5 million as a reason to get their support. They're at their weakest right now. Right here, right now, they're at their weakest with a formidable enemy in the Parkland kids. Folks, these kids own that right to push for gun control. They own it, and the NRA knows that. So yes, we should embrace what Trump is saying about gun control, and by doing so, we'll give these arguments more oxygen, because that oxygen for gun control isn't going to come from the Republican side. It just isn't going to happen. They're going to sit there on their hands. Nothing will happen. It's up to us to give those arguments the oxygen that they need to let that fire burn for gun control. And if you wonder why the Republicans are sitting on their hands and will continue to sit on their hands about gun control, Trump is right when he says that they're afraid of the NRA. And this article in my show notes from the New York Times shows you why. Check it out. It's in the show notes. Folks, it's all about the money. And you know what? We're damn lucky here in Iowa that to have grabbed almost $4 million NRA dollars through Senator Joni Ernst and Congressman David Young. We're so lucky. This article is the list of people who will push back the hardest and scream the loudest that any legislation that doesn't solve the gun problem by putting more guns in the hands of people is a travesty. That's what the NRA wants, is more guns. That's their answer to everything. So this is the list, folks, in that article. Go to that article in my show notes and see if your legislator is on the take from the NRA. You might be surprised. You might be surprised who you find on that list. And while we're on a roll here about the NRA, I want to share with you another tidbit of their insanity. And that is, in the age of computers, the NRA forces us to keep gun records on paper and microfilm? You've got to be kidding. And this article is coming to us from GQ. Again, it's in my show notes. I encourage you to check it out. But that's right, folks. It's paper and microfilm and Charlie Houser. And old Charlie Houser is the ATF boss that runs the portion of the government that maintains the owner database of guns for all of the gun shops in the nation that have closed. Just the ones that have closed. Charlie Houser, West Virginia, ATF boss. In that warehouse is the one that maintains those records. And at that warehouse, they get emails from police and calls every day saying, "Can you type in the serial number and tell me who the gun is registered to?" They get 1,500 of those requests a day, every day of the week. The police think it's like a VIN number on a car. You type it in. Police from everywhere. "Can you just type that number in and tell me who owns the gun?" Well, from Charlie here that runs the operation, there's a news flash, and I quote him, "We ain't got a registration system. Ain't nobody registering no damn guns." There's no national database of guns, folks. We have no centralized record of who owns all the firearms we vigorously debate about. There's no hard data regarding how many people own them, how many of them are bought or sold, or how many even exist. All we've got is Charlie. And he says it's a shoestring budget, Charlie says, who runs this center. It's not 10,000 agents in a big sophisticated place. It's a bunch of friggin' boxes, all half-assed records. We have about 50 ATF employees, and all the rest are basically the ladies. The ladies that live in West Virginia, and they got a job. There's a huge amount of labor being put into looking through microfilm. Microfilm? Are they still using microfilm instead of a computer database? Yes. Yes. The National Tracing Center in West Virginia is not allowed to have a centralized computer database. That's a big no-no, says Charlie. That's been a federal law thanks to the NRA since 1986, Charlie says. No searchable database of America's gun owners. So people here have to use paper. They've got to sort through enormous stacks of forms and record books that gun stores are required to keep. And eventually they have to turn them over to the feds. That's Charlie, when requested. It's kind of like a library, folks, in the old days, without the card catalog. I mean, how would you find a book without the card catalog? Good luck. They use, at this warehouse, they use pictures of paper like microfilm. The big news here, they recently got the go-ahead to convert microfilm to the PDFs, as long as the pictures of paper are not searchable. You have to flip through each one and read it. No searching by gun owner is allowed. No searching by name is allowed. And get this, folks, the records are stacked in boxes sky high. They're in shipping containers sitting in the parking lot. Anywhere they've got space, they're running out of room. On a shoestring budget. And all these records in West Virginia at the Tracing Center are from gun shops that have closed because in this weird world that we live in, folks, where the NRA can do whatever the hell they want and get away with it, gun shops are demanded to keep the records of gun owners until the day they close shop. Then all those records get packed up, they get sent to Charlie at his ATF warehouse in West Virginia. And that amounts to almost 2 million new gun records every month that he's got to figure out what to do with. Almost 2 million slips of paper that record the sale of a gun, who bought it and where, like a glorified receipt. And if you take pictures of the gun records, you can save space. Charlie says that 2 million images, you know, it's 2 million photo shots. I've got to have at least 7 microfilm machines running 16 hours a day or otherwise. Otherwise, I fall behind. And to fall behind means that instead of 5,000 boxes in process, there's maybe 5,500 tomorrow. Wow. In the area where they do the imaging of these new records, folks, in this area, a whole wall of ladies do nothing but remove staples from the incoming records from 6 a.m. in the morning to midnight, every day. Every day. All they do is remove staples. And what hasn't changed over the years of record keeping done by bits of paper eventually scanned to microfilm is the fact that in 2013, U.S. gun manufacturers rolled out 10,800,000 guns. And on top of that, we imported an additional 5,500,000 guns. So over 15 million guns. The numbers were actually astounding the year before, and the year before that, and the year before that. Over 15 million new guns in the U.S. every year. And you mean to tell me that we can't put this registry of gun owners on a database? Really? Just because the NRA said so in 1986? Let me tell you that the idea of behind, the whole idea of behind this idea, this catastrophe of not putting these records on a database, if the whole idea is to thwart any government takeover, then you're just kidding yourself, because if that were to occur, we would have a lot more problems to worry about than having a database of gun owners the government might seek out. I mean, think about that. If the government goes that bad, folks, if it goes that haywire, a database of gun owners or not, you know, whether it's on computer or on pieces of paper, it's not going to make any difference. And it's foolish to think keeping a gun registry locked in some version of the 1960s will change any of that. It's foolish. So keep in mind that the records that they house in West Virginia at the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Warehouse are just from the gun shops that have closed. If a crime occurs, the police have to call the ATF warehouse. That's where it starts. And then they do the search. The search begins for the gun's owner, made all the more complicated by the fact that the gun stores hold all the records for the owners as long as they are in business. All the myriad of shops throughout the United States, for those active gun shops, they hold those records as long as they are in business. So how do you trace a gun whose records are sitting in any number of gun shops throughout the U.S.? Another question that you should be asking is yourself is, why does the NRA have so much power that law enforcement is severely encumbered in trying to find a gun owner when a crime is committed? Why? Why do we allow this? Why does it continue? Why does it continue? Well, the first step in a policeman trying to figure out who the gun's owner is, the first step is to describe the gun to the warehouse in West Virginia, the ATF. They start with describing the gun, which could be from anywhere in the United States as well as anywhere in the world, and to determine what kind of gun it is, the ATF uses their skill set from years and years and years, and along with various gun catalog resources to determine the maker of that gun. And first thing they have to do is help the police figure out what kind of gun it is, and then help them determine where and which number on that gun is the serial number. It's insane. Then the second step that they have to go through is that they then call the manufacturer, if it's a U.S.-made gun, or that they call the importer for the case of a foreign-made gun, and the ATF person wants to know which wholesaler the gun maker sold that weapon to. Basically, you just call up and you say, hey, who did you sell this gun to? So that leads you to step three, is to then call that wholesaler and ask to whom they sold the gun to. So the manufacturer gets called, then the wholesaler gets called, and then once you find out where the gun was sold to, and let's just say, for example, it was Walmart, for example, you then have to call that specific store location wherever it is. Wherever it is. In the case of Walmart, with all these thousands of stores, they don't hold the records in Arkansas. No, you've got to call that store in Timbuktu. You got to call the gun counter. I guess while the guy's trying to sell a gun to somebody else, he puts you on hold. I don't know how that works. I mean, you call the gun salesman at that store, at the gun counter. And by law, every gun dealer in America has to keep a bound book or an orderly arrangement of loose leaf pages to record every firearms manufacturer or importer, the model number, the serial number, the type of gun it is, the caliber or gauge that it is, the date it was received, and the date of sale. So that record information, which doesn't include the gun's owner, this record corresponds to the store's stack of 4473s, which is the government form, which some clerk then has to go through at the store and dig through in order to read you the information on the form. Or he might fax it if you're lucky. That's what you do if the shop is still in business, folks. If not, you end up searching through one of Charlie's boxes in that warehouse in West Virginia, or going through the millions of miles of microfilm, where they get up to 2 million new records every month from gun shops that have closed. And you look through the records of that closed gun shop to find the one piece of paper with the owner's name on it. They do that 1,500 times a day. And despite their best record keeping, with all the nuances of the system nationwide and all of their experience, despite all of that, they're only able to trace a gun to an owner 65% of the time. So folks, if the NRA, if they've got so much power that they can literally control how we in the U.S. manage our gun records, as if we're in some sort of 1960s time warp, they've got too much power. If we can't pass sensible gun legislation time and time again after every mass shooting because our legislators are afraid of the NRA, they've got too much power. And it's folks, it's just high time that we change all of that. We've got an anything-goes stronghold here that the NRA has perpetuated. They've got a death grip over us that has been allowed to perpetuate, and they've got too much power as a result. Think about that. And when you hear pushback about the NRA, just think about what they've done to make this whole system damn miserable. They've got too much power. Well, folks, I want to thank you for joining us. And as always, you can reach us at restedcultureradar@gmail.com. Until then, I want to thank you, and we will see you next time.